This call is being recorded.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. So we actually just made quorum. Terrific. Thank you. Sorry, next time we will have a clearer list for identifying this. It gets a little complicated with all of the district representatives. So thank you very much. Great. So I will announce at 10:10 that we have reached quorum. So thank you all very much. Okay, so moving on. Our first action is approval of the April 20th HIE Policy Board meeting minutes. Does anyone want to move?
Move to approve with any technical changes that the staff may need to make.
Thank you very much. Do I have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Great.
Aye.
Thank you. minutes from April 20th are approved pending any technical. Thank you. Okay, so the first thing for this morning that I get to do is obviously, you know, we always like to start, you know, with reiterating our mission and vision for the HIE Policy Board, which you all are familiar with, but it's always good to start there. But the really fun thing that I get to do this morning is make sure that you all have a chance to meet the new staff for the Health IT program who have all come on board within the last couple of months. Really pleased to have them joining DHCF. And in fact, in future, one of the reasons I'm extremely pleased is because they will be providing more of these reports than I will, and I'll be moving into a facilitation role. So yay on that front. So, you know, the team has really been built out. I think probably by the end of this month or early next, fingers crossed, we'll have completely actually restructured this team. We'll have a completely new set of faces, but, you know, a very complementary group of folks and the skills that they bring to health information exchange and health information technology really are, I think, unparalleled. And so we're very, very pleased to have them join us. So what I will let them do is actually I'll turn it over to Noah Smith, who's our new program manager for the Health IT program, and he's going to sort of walk you through introductions and help introduce the rest of the team. So Noah, please take it away.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
How are you all? Good to meet you all. I'm Noah Smith, as Aaron said, the new program manager for health information technology here at DHCF. It's a pleasure to be with you, and thanks for joining. Very quickly, I come from the federal government, where I worked for the U.S. Department of Transportation for several years on emergency care policy and health IT policy, believe it or not, at USDOT. And so this was a fantastic opportunity to apply that experience to the real world and to the community I've lived in for the last 12 years or so. So it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm excited to lead the team and implement a lot of the recommendations that are coming out of this body. So I also ran a federal advisory committee for 5 years, and so I know a little bit about advisory committees and how to sort of be most effective and useful, and I'm excited to sort of start that conversation with each of you and make sure that we're using all of your time appropriately and making sure that we're sort of getting the most out of your expertise and your experience. So we really appreciate it. The team, as Aaron said, has had quite a bit of turnover over the last year, but we've put together what I think is an incredible team. Aaron has really put together what I think is an incredible team. We'll start with Eduarda Koch, who's trying to leave, who is now our project manager over the Medicaid EHR incentive program. She comes from Children's National, and Eduarda, if you want to stand up, say hello, and introduce yourself.
Eduarda Koch, as Noah mentioned, I'm from Children's National.
Eduarda, do you maybe mind coming a little closer to the mic here for the folks on
the mic?
Make sure there's one right next to Noah.
So I'm really, really excited to be here. I bring a provider's level approach to the program.
We are overjoyed to have Eduarda have the experience of actually implementing the programs that DHCF has been putting out for the last several years. Already, you know, she's been able to guide us through what the providers are actually thinking and doing when we make decisions and what's working and what isn't. And so her experience is going to be invaluable for the program. Denise Sawyer, you have already met several times, but Denise, if you want to say hello.
Good
Good morning, everybody. Great to see you again. This is my second policy board meeting on staff. Quick background, I've been with district government for a little over 5 years at this point, and with the HCF for 3 of those years. Excited to join the team and bring my data background into it and learn more and do some great things.
Absolutely. So Denise is leading our technical assistance and outreach portfolio and our contract with DCPCA and Zane Networks, among other things. And so we're overjoyed to have Denise and to have that experience at DHCF as well. And then we have a vacant CS13 analyst position. We have an offer pending with a fantastic individual who has many years of experience at PwC in the private sector and administering a large FQHC in Texas. So far, so good. So I won't make any promises, and I won't say what that person's name is. But we're very hopeful that that person will be on board by the end of the summer, and they'll be working closely with the HIE Policy Board. So their role will really be around health information exchange, sustainability, and stakeholder outreach, and working directly with the board. So we are very excited to have that person on and dedicate proper resources to this vital function. So that's the team. We're happy to be here.
Great. Well, thanks, Noah. And I think there's some more room. So particularly, I know, Denise, you're going to be presenting some material. You know, and if anyone wants to grab a seat, I think we've got plenty of room. So please feel free to come on up, join the discussion. Great. So the next thing I just want to talk about really briefly, you know, I'm a big believer, obviously, in the fact that the HA Policy Board was really helpful in setting an agenda in terms of ongoing tasks and roles, activities and deliverables we're responsible for this year, and then really thinking about what were the recommendations that the HA Policy Board was making. So just wanted to update this snapshot of the year for you all based on progress to date. We have moved a couple of things around due to new information. So things like when we're going to talk about the designation process, it turned out that we got a ruling in May from the mayor's office that we could actually proceed to developing designation rules without a few additional steps that we thought were going to be required. So that kind of changes the time frame. We also have received some new information from CMS regarding when they want information from us on our IAPD in order to ensure continuity of current operations. So NOAA is going to provide more information on that, but again, so shifts the time frame a little bit. But by and large, I think we're doing really well with respect to pursuing the agenda that you all laid out earlier in the year. So just a couple of quick updates here. You know, today we're going to be talking about feedback on the HIE tools and DDI, the development and deployment and implementation of the work that CRISP and DCPCA are doing. And we think that's really important because these are obviously foundational investments for the HIE, and we want to make sure that you're involved in that process. So that's an add here. We also have needed to move the sustainability special session that we've been talking about to next month, which we're in the process of trying to schedule. I know it's a tough month to schedule. We'll do the best that we can. But really, due to a couple of other factors, as well as the input we received from you all in the spring, that we really wanted to expand the number of groups that we were meeting with, felt like it would be important to push that back. And then in September, we're going to have, based on all this information that's coming out of the SMHP, you know, our state IT plan for Medicaid, we're going to compile a lot of information, really present it in September to talk more about use cases and IAPD projects that we want to pursue that would be new. So there will be more discussed about that today. And then we're really going to push the stakeholder engagement plan, the high-level sustainability plan, to the December meeting so that we have all these other inputs that we've been working on available to inform that discussion. So any questions about this sort of change in time frame, but again, you know, just reiterating largely that the same set of objectives that you all had put on the table a couple months ago are still what we're pursuing, and we're moving on as rapidly as possible. And I want to give the team credit, because especially with two folks who have just come on board in the last 2 months, for a couple of months it was just me and the health IT team, and then for a couple more months it was just me and Denise. So kudos to everyone that we're largely staying on track. So any questions about the timeline or, you know, what we're hoping to achieve? Okay, great. So I think I've mentioned most of this. We will have the special meeting on sustainability, hopefully in mid-August, so be on the lookout for another doodle poll. We appreciate your patience as we're trying to schedule. The hope is the sustainability subcommittee will present findings from the interviews, and that Clinovation's GovHealth will also present progress on the SMHP, including information they've gleaned from some other interviews and focus groups. And here I should note that this was really serendipitous, that the work the sustainability subcommittee had led fed into a set of questions and structure for the protocol that then Clinovation's GovHealth has been able to pick up on and use and in a few areas expand to fulfill our requirement for CMS. So our great thanks to the sustainability subcommittee and Allison to your leadership for getting that going, because it's really helped, I think, spur the work of the SMHP while also supporting the sustainability subcommittee's objectives. And so you all have an opportunity to review findings from a lot of this work and then provide feedback at that time. We have really been out meeting with a lot of members of the community as part of this process. So this is not, I just want to emphasize how much activity has happened in June and July. Folks are out every week really talking with different groups, and I think there was a very robust plan to ensure outreach to everyone from, the payers in the community to independent practice clinicians, to community groups and other associations. So that's going really, really well, and we're getting some terrific feedback and developing important relationships. And again, the SMHP activities, I guess, Denise, I'll turn from this slide over to you. Do you want to provide a shape?
Sure, absolutely. So as Erin mentioned, as part of our TA and outreach contract that was awarded in March of this year, we've been working very closely with Clinovation's GovHealth, who's supporting the development of our revision to our SMHP. They've done a number of activities thus far to support this. They're conducting an environmental scan of existing sources of data and collecting additional data. They're organizing, facilitating, and supporting meetings, as well as focus groups to collect feedback and input from the community stakeholders. But also want to emphasize that we're reaching out to consumers and beneficiaries as well and getting their perspective. They're also preparing some narrative content as well as graphs and visuals. If we go over to the next slide, what we really want to do with this version of the SMHB is treat this as an opportunity to really reframe the conversation around HIT and HIE in the district. So certainly the SMHB is a CMS requirement. All states are required to answer a set of questions, but you know, we really want to go beyond that. Certainly we want to fulfill that obligation, but we really want to emphasize how the district is sort of moving from HIT, HIE implementation, so the process, and how we're shifting over more towards using technology to support practice transformation and improvement in outcomes. Next slide. So just very quickly, our progress to date, we've been doing a lot of work with Clinovation. We have an outline so far of the SMHB that we're currently reviewing internally, and the first section has been drafted, so we're reworking that a little bit, which will be shared with you certainly. Erin already touched on the stakeholder interviews that we've conducted in support of this effort, but also as part of the sustainability outreach subcommittee. Our focus groups are scheduled for next week. Very excited about that. Also want to emphasize that as part of these focus groups, we are taking a very close look on health equity and social determinants of health and how that ties in to health information technology. So far, some themes that have come up based on our findings in these interviews. EHR adoption and value to practice is rising in the district, which is great. The data accessibility, and there's poor quality of data. contributes to a lack of buy-in. Data analytics infrastructure is needed for value-based purchasing. So we're getting more and more information from the community. So there's certainly more to come very soon.
A question on the emerging themes. The data accessibility, is that information blocking?
Information blocking.
In some cases, yeah. That's what, that certainly has emerged.
And the quality, is that because there may be multiple sources of the same information that might be different?
So the primary thing we've heard is actually how systems are being implemented to collect data and whether the completeness and timeliness of the data is sufficient for groups, for practices to rely on that information. It's probably the main theme I've heard today.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other? Yes, ma'am.
I imagine, I don't know actually whether the questions that you're asking in the interviews are substantially different from those you're asking in the focus group.
They're tweaked ever so slightly.
Okay.
I'd be happy to share that with you.
Okay. Let's just be curious. And then I'm also curious whether the same themes are emerging across all stakeholders or whether that there's variation.
I think definitely we will know more about that after next week.
Okay.
Sure. Especially after we talk to consumers.
Okay.
Yeah. It would be interesting to see for sure.
Yeah, I did want to emphasize that for the special topic, the health equity and social determinants of health focus group that is being run, two important things at that. One is a suggestion to hold that focus group came from a meeting that we held in May on social determinants of health with a number of stakeholders, and they all said we'd really like for you to look at this as an area of focus when you do your SMHP. Those questions are obviously substantially different. So if you're particularly interested in those, that might be an area where folks just want to take a look at what questions are being asked. So,
yeah. And then how many are you planning to do for each of those two bullets?
For each of
focus groups.
Yeah.
So there's four focus
there
groups
four.
Total?
Okay. And two on each.
I think it's only one on social determinants.
So,
okay.
But yeah, there are two on social determinants, one that's more provider-focused and one that's more consumer-focused under that umbrella.
Got it.
And then we're also doing one focused on behavioral health and then another one on ambulatory providers.
Got it.
And maybe, Denise, before you... Oh, go ahead, please.
Sorry, this is Kelly Cronin from ONC. I was just wondering if it'd be possible to get some high-level summaries of what's coming out of this because it seems so valuable.
So that's a great point, Kelly. That will be the focus of the August special session that we're putting up.
Okay,
so,
got it.
We'll have the summaries and a lengthy discussion about the material that's been collected.
Okay, terrific. So so there'll probably be a presentation mid-August, and then would there be like a Word document, a summary?
Yeah, Denise, do you want to talk about the products coming out of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Our colleagues at Clinton Agents are taking very copious notes while we're conducting these interviews. So we plan to put together a deliverable kind of highlighting all the themes that are coming out of that, and then additional details from the interview, so that will all be presented to you. As we come to kind of a draft that we're comfortable with, we will also be sharing that with you because certainly want to get your input and your feedback as we're developing the SMHP.
Sure. Terrific. And I just would add that for the August meeting, we in ONC, we've been doing some convening on SDOH as well. In fact, we have a workshop coming up next week on this topic. And I know Allison Ryan and her other hats, she's been doing a lot of relevant work in partnership with others, including RWJ. So I think we could probably add to the discussion around that.
Absolutely. Actually, Kelly, I'm signed up for that webinar next Wednesday.
Oh,
it's on my calendar.
Oh, good, good.
I believe our folks at Clinovations are signed up for it as well. But at least I will be on there for sure.
So real quick, this is Noah. I just wanted to add, adding on to Allison's question around whether we're seeing these themes from across different stakeholder types. And one thing to review before the August meeting may be a summary of responses to our RFI on ACOs, which was published on our website yesterday, and we'd be happy to send out a link to that. One thing that I think was really important coming out of that RFI was that getting a plurality of stakeholders responding to that RFI, one of the really only unifying theme among all respondents, right, was that health information exchange and the ability, that sort of direct connection, is absolutely vital to sustaining an ACO in the system. So we took that as a really positive thing. And so when things like data analytics infrastructures being needed for value-based purchasing, you know, we're looking really closely at those RFI responses and seeing those themes emerge from all types of stakeholders. So we'll be sure to send out a link to a summary of the responses to that RFI. I think it'll match up really well with what we're hearing in these stakeholder interviews as well.
And if folks want a copy of it, if you're in the room, it's available on the back table. So, great. Thank you, Noah. Thank you, Denise. Okay, so Denise, just want to make sure, I think you are continuing to in the next section. Yeah.
So I wanted to announce that we received another extension from CMS for program year 2016 of the Medicaid EHR incentive program.
And can I just add really quickly, that was always the plan. We knew that CMS would only give us, you know, sort of short extensions, but we were hoping that they would give us an extension through the end of August, and they did, so.
Yeah, which is great, but this is really it. This is the last.
Yeah.
This is really the last opportunity. So I shared a very similar slide at the previous policy board meeting. So again, I'm kind of making a call to you all to please help us spread the word. You know, this is a great opportunity for providers to receive up to $63,750 for full participation in all years of the MIP, including just over $21,000 in the first year alone, just to adopt, implement, or upgrade. Donna, did you want to add anything to this to highlight?
Only that for organizations that have already been engaged in the process, that there could be a focus on new providers that have not yet been engaged. So it's not just, you know, a complete organization that has never done any of this meaningful use stuff. It's the new providers that are added to the staff of organizations that get the benefit of these dollars. So it's an opportunity for organizations to get some additional dollars to help with the implementation of new technologies internally.
I just have a question. Are you researching our provider data management system to pull out the new providers, people who've signed up for enrolled in Medicaid recently? Are we doing data matches so that you can target your outreach efforts?
We are, actually. And if we go to the next slide,
this is just the website for eHealthCC, if just to know there's a place to send if you're interested. But I think this is what you want, right?
Yes, exactly. So kind of early on in this process, I conducted some analysis, of course, to identify, sort of answer that question, what is our universe of eligible professionals that we can target? So we identified over 1,600 providers that we thought would likely meet the 30% Medicaid patient volume threshold. And from there,
could you repeat that threshold?
Our colleagues at Zane Networks and DCPPA have been conducting targeted outreach based on provider Medicaid claims volume and or practice size. So providers who are seeing more patients are getting targeted first, and so we have kind of this tiered approach to our outreach strategy. Since March, I'm happy to announce that we've been able to contact all 1,600 providers in one form or another, either through a mailing or through phone calls or through in-person outreach. Over 800 providers have actually been engaged in a conversation. And thus far, 58 providers have signed up to receive technical assistance. So we're very excited to be working with them and helping them get through the state level registry.
What about the ones that don't meet the 30%?
Question?
They are really ineligible for
the care continuum, because a dermatologist may not hit the 30% mark. So if it says someone who's going to a dermatologist, we're not going to get that data in.
But unfortunately, that's the requirement of the program. Mm-hmm.
Not our.
Just pointing out that we have a there's a gap there.
There are many providers that don't qualify. I mean, the federal. I'm no expert on this, but the federal requirements for meaningful use do not target the full spectrum of providers out there to serve our population, and nursing homes and others aren't eligible for the incentive. They can be part of this, but the incentive was originally targeted to a very small universe of providers.
And it misses behavioral health.
Yeah. No, we are aware of that.
What were the program targets? Because there was a universe of 1,600 providers that would have likely met that threshold of 30% and had them engaged in conversations, but 58 seems low to me, having signed up to receive technical assistance. So as a program, did you all set a number of expectations for the number of people who would be receiving technical assistance and are now implementing some types of strategies to get more people involved in trying to receive technical assistance? I mean, I know we have a lot of things going on to try to implement more uptake of HIT and HIE efforts, but that seems low.
Well, I think, so there are some realities, and you in doing the outreach, you find that some of that 1,600 don't meet the 30% threshold.
Okay.
So there's that piece of it.
Okay.
There's some folks that are just not interested in participating in this kind of program for whatever reason. There are, and of those that having the continual conversation, there's an agreement that folks have to sign because they have to make a commitment to participation and engaging in the process. So that's a process too. So what activities are underway? I mean, we have call center folks that are reaching out and contacting providers and bringing them up to date and scheduling meetings, going to practices, but it's a process, and the process basically just started in April, May. So it's we're getting there, but.
So I guess,
Dr. Freeman?
Dr. Freeman, give me 2 seconds. So I think from my perspective, how one of the ways I would encourage us to think through this is we have an opportunity for people to take advantage of incentives that's being missed. And so how do we formally use this as an extension of the interviews and focus groups to learn from this to inform future opportunities? So how is there some type of formal documentation? You know, we apply this to other things that we do, after action reports, et cetera, to say in a very formal and concrete way, well, where we reviewed the data and assumed there were 1,600 people who met the 30% threshold, the number was actually 1,400. That other 200 didn't meet that threshold, and this is how we figure that out. In our interactions with people where we were proactively trying to recruit them, these are the actual reasons they listed for why they would not be interested in the program or participation barriers. And then moving forward, we are able to establish a very strategic initiative that worked to eliminate those barriers to participation. And then for the people who do participate in the program, interviewing them and figuring out why they had no barriers to participation and why they hadn't taken up the program on their own, or what it was that we offered that was really the thing that got them involved in the first place. So I guess I would be looking for some very intentional processes through this effort that would help inform anything that we would do the next time. So looking at this as being as informative of a process to
I'm smiling, LaQuandra, and sorry, Dr. Freeman, one sec, because this is I have been driving the team nuts with all these requests to make sure that all the information collected in the content management system will allow us to look at some of those questions. Because I think that partially because we got a later start, one of the best things we can do is ensure we know what our universe is, trying to understand what that map of providers is out there, and make sure that everybody has been touched with this message at least two or three times, right? And then that we've done the best we can to get everybody who expresses interest into this process. Now, I will say one of the other things, so the target that the group set to get people through AIU was 85 providers. So we're not so far off of that. So I want to acknowledge that the team said, realistically speaking, they thought they could get 85 folks through AIU, right? Mm-hmm. That was the goal. And I had a bit of the same reaction, right? But I do understand that given the limited time frame and how intensive an effort it is to get somebody through that first step, that first set of steps, that probably is a reasonable goal for us to keep in mind. So they're about two-thirds of the way there. So I think, you know, we should be reasonably pleased with that. The other thing I just want to note that we are seeing is a lot of contract employees. So it's really difficult to connect the patients to some of these institutions and the EPs because they're contractors. And so we'll report on all this when we get more information, but I think we should have a pretty good sense of what the network should look like soon.
And one other piece is that of that number that were eligible, there are some significant numbers that have started the process in other states.
Yeah.
And so that sort of narrows the field to, for example, the health centers. There's some health centers that went through Maryland. So those providers have already been accounted for, and so we reduce the numbers by that. So it's that kind of stuff. It's a bunch of factors.
And Maryland, because they did their own process, removed some requirements that we have in D.C. and that most other states have with a shared state-level registry. And so it is probable that despite some of the fact that those groups had said they might want to come back to D.C., that they may not just because of the logistics. So I apologize, Dr. Freeman. Thanks for holding in your question. We'll turn to you.
Well, I commend you, I think, for all of the great efforts that you have been doing and for the successes you've had. One of the things that concerns me is that we don't often, at least from past experience with our policy board, we don't seem to value having peer-to-peer outreach, having physicians reaching out to physicians. And I hope that you would at least consider that. I'd be glad to help in any way I could on that front. And while we're on that subject, the issue is, have we been at least sending out notices to, like, the Medical Society of D.C., to D.C. MedCI, which is the National Medical Association's D.C. chapter, to the D.C. chapter for the American Academy of Family Physicians, to ACP, American College of Physicians for Internal Medicine, and the AAP. Even if we don't get much yield from that, the notice to them would actually be great advertising that we're actually active in doing things. So I would hopefully at least consider those. In addition to that, I would consider the Medical Group Management Association, which would be practice managers.
Yeah, these are all great suggestions. We have reached out to most of the major associations through our transmittal process, but Don, I don't know if you want to comment on how eHealth DC has leveraged work with providers. I mean, that would be a determination and a question for you all. I think it sounds like a good idea, but maybe that's something you could check in with Dr. Freeman
about. Yeah, and Dr. Freeman, follow up with you about that, but it's my understanding that there has been outreach at least to the societies, at least one attempt at outreach and continuing contact with those folks. And I know that there are plans to attend the different meetings, and we've done some of that stuff. We're going to do the Ward 8 Council
Health Council
meeting, which is I think in August. And
So Luigi went earlier this week, there's another meeting.
There's a back-to-school thing
August 12th.
August 12th, that they're going to do a Saturday kind of event, be there, and so they're, we're doing as much outreach as we can to try to,
But still, hearing from a peer on this gives it a greater legitimacy than hearing from administrators, IT experts, and government officials. So I think there is some added value in that if you want to go down that road.
Yeah, terrific okay. point. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, so Donna, can we put that?
In a physician practice, who is the decision maker that says that would be the person? Who are we pitching to? Is it the doctor
depends.
Or the person who
it
runs?
Varies.
The,
it varies.
It varies. Okay.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons it's more intense.
So a lot of times there's like a practice administrator, but the physicians themselves can sabotage the effort. So, I mean, I would know, right? that's what happens in
yeah.
reality, you know. If they're like still, I mean, that's
old school.
That's right. That's what happens. And then, you know, in D.C. we have a good mix of large group practices and small independent practices, and because of that mix, it's not half and half by any means, but we have a good enough mix that it's Dr. Freeman's excellent suggestion of having peer-to-peer outreach is very well warranted. And then there's, you know, these ward-based councils, they don't draw physician participation.
Yeah.
So like the Ward 8 Health Council yeah. and the Health Alliance Network, physicians don't actively participate in those en masse. You may have two or three physicians who are interested in advocacy work who show up and provide some guidance to them, but physicians who are very clinically active are not highly active in those councils providing peer-to-peer support and peer-to-peer leadership to their fellow physician colleagues. I mean, that's not sort of what those do as part of their charge or their mission. I think looking more at the professional societies like the medical society, MSDC and MedCI, as Dr. Freeman suggested, and the specialty societies would be more where you would find larger groups of actively practicing physicians than some of the ward-based councils.
And the group did present to the Dental Association not that long ago, and we went out to UMC and talked to the medical practice group. One other quick stat I thought you might find interesting, LaQuandra, is that about of that 1,600 number, almost 900 of them are nurse practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still trying to figure out the disposition. I mean, I think that's a really useful statistic, actually, because we're still trying to figure out kind of who are those people, how are they employed, you know, how closely connected. We're finding that a lot of them, right, have contract positions where they split their time even between D.C. and Maryland.
Correct.
So, I mean.
And even with, when I'm meeting with a lot of the CEOs of some of the health systems, one of the key questions that I ask them is what are their FTE ratios for physicians and mid-levels? And many of them, their mid-levels have a higher proportion of clinical time than their physicians because their physicians may have more admin responsibilities or executive roles in their clinical environment, especially their primary care clinical environment. So by FTE count, their mid-levels are spending more time in clinical roles. They may be, you know, 0.8 or one full FTE clinically, whereas their physicians are 0.5 clinical FTE. And so that's how you end up with more of the patients being ascribed to a nurse practitioner as their primary care provider.
Right. Well, and it sort of goes back to Jim's earlier point, too. What can we do to help support connectivity among the folks who sort of fall between these gaps that, again, may be more pronounced in the district because of where we sit relative to these other employment markets? So, I mean, this may be an area where perhaps there's a small group of folks who are willing and interested to come together with us and DCPCA as the contractor on the outreach effort and really sort of think through some of the information that we'll have access to, I think, by the next month or so, and really think about how can we, you know, maximize what we know now to promote outreach and connectivity. So, so we may come back to you on that next month or so. Because I think there's you know, this should be a data-driven approach.
Yeah, I think, this is Noah, I think it's important to remember that this is specific to the MEIP program, but that's not the only kind of outreach, not the only kind of support that we want to provide. So even for folks who would not be eligible for the incentive, getting them connected to HIE tools, and ensuring that their practice has the access to the right information is just as important as, you know, $21,000 in the first year might be. So money is one thing, but connectivity is something else that this group and our peers can provide, and we're certainly thinking about that.
Right, and it's part of the existing TA and outreach contract, so we should come back to that. Okay, great. I know we've taken about 10 extra minutes on this conversation, but I think it's been well worth it. And Noah, do you want to talk, bring us home with the IAPD submission?
Yeah, so just very quickly, wanted to provide an update on where we are with our IAPD requests. So the last IAPD that DHCF submitted was in January of this year. It was approved in March, and that's where you're seeing all the work, the grant with CRISP, the contract with DCPCA and Zane. It also funded our sort of internal MEIP attestation process and some contract staff for us. Those grants and contracts continue past September 30th, 2017, and so we need our funding to continue past September 30th, 2017. What's important for you all to understand is that we're actually going to submit two IAPDs. We're calling the first one a continuation IAPD, which is a term we just made up, that we're actually going to be submitting next week, that says that asks CMS for 90-10 matched funding to continue the work that has already been approved. So part of that would be an extension of the HIE grant, not new money and not new scope, but an extension to allow CRISP to really finish their work and make sure that it is complete and has met the needs of our customers. And that would likely be through the end of the calendar year or maybe a little beyond. This would also allow us to exercise an option year with the TA and outreach contract and to continue our MEIP contract through March 2018, where then we'll have to decide what to do next with that. So this is just about continuing the services that we already have. There will be a new IAPD that we're going to be writing and submitting in early calendar year 2018, and that's really where all the sort of new innovative HIT and HIE initiatives are going to be formulated and requested. So that's important for this group because we, of course, committed to going to you all first to hear your recommendations for innovative IAPD requests for the district. And as Aaron showed in the slide earlier with our sort of timeline, we're looking at the September meeting to really focus on hearing from you and hearing from the folks that you represent and work with about what those innovative IAPD asks, HIT and HIE related asks would be. And then we would focus on writing that IAPD in sort of October and November and submitting it in early 2018. So we want to make sure that you know that, you know, even though we're submitting an IAPD next week, that's not what we're talking about when it's sort of like the new innovative stuff. That's still on the table, and our focus of the September meeting is really going to be about hearing from each of you about what should be in that proposal. The projects that would be funded through that IAPD would go through the end of fiscal year 19. So that is where, that's our timeline and sort of our plan for IAPD funding for the next two fiscal years. Any questions on that so we can help answer?
Great. Right. Thanks, Noah. So
thank
more
you.
To more to come here. Okay. So, one of the things that obviously is on our timeline was to talk to you all about HIE designation and actually review a set of draft rules. I will just sort of tee this conversation up, which Denise is going to lead along with Donna about the work that the HIE designation committee has been doing. I just want to say great, you know, express my thanks to the subcommittee members, several of whom are policy board members, but we've also brought in a number of other perspectives from around the country, including folks like Mike Nochet from Verinovum, which is, he's been connected with HIE in Arkansas for a long time. They're doing a lot of very innovative work. In addition, you know, we've had our privacy officer, Laura Payne, participate in these efforts. So they've just really been a set of very robust discussions, and everyone has done their homework for the five meetings that we've had, which in some cases has been some pretty intensive reading, so you know, thought work, so we really appreciate that. And again, the committee has met now five times between the late spring and this meeting, and I think they've been really terrific conversations and are moving us forward, particularly since, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we have sort of changed our time frame a little bit because actually one administrative hurdle has kind of been, you know, taken out of the process, and so that means we're moving even more swiftly now to try and make this designation process a reality. So with that, who should I turn it over to? Denise, Donna, do you want to start by just reiterating the goals of the work group and getting the conversation
going? Yeah, I can teed off.
Okay. And then a quick note on time. I'm going to take the chair's prerogative and move the Chris demonstration to probably closer to 11:25. So if that's all right with you guys. Okay. So you have until 11:25.
Okay, great. So if we go over to the next slide. So what we want to do with the designation subcommittee is to really create a structure for the BCHIE and what that means. Your next slide, please. Thank you. So we want to focus on establishing one set of standards to ensure that all HIEs are able and willing to meet district standards and expectations for exchange. We want to formalize partnerships, facilitate a more direct level of cooperation between the government and current stakeholders. And then we want to streamline the district's ability to provide resources and allow the district to be more nimble in responding to changing technologies, policies, and of course, the HIE needs of stakeholders. And ultimately, the goal is to ensure sustainable exchange of health information in support of district's health reform efforts. Next slide, please. So what I'll do is I'll quickly just tee up some of the current activity that's going on with the subcommittee, but then the more conversation that we're going to be having, I will hand over to Donna, our vice chair, to oversee. So we've been doing a lot of work with our subcommittee. We've developed a formal definition of HIE, which you all will be reviewing, poking and prodding later today. We've reviewed several state approaches to HIE designation, including Maryland, New York, Pennsylvania, Minnesota. And what the subcommittee decided to do is to actually use the Maryland regulations really as a foundation for the district's regulations, because of its emphasis on privacy and security, and also just the structure was quite similar to the way that the district's regulations are also laid out in general. So as Erin mentioned earlier on in the meeting, we received approval to go ahead and proceed with developing the rules. And we've developed the first draft of those rules, and we're currently revising based on subcommittee feedback, but we'll certainly be presenting that to you at the next meeting. Erin already mentioned a lot of this. I have a timeline here for your reference. I don't want to go too much into it just because of time, but our ultimate goal here is to publish a rule to the register in early 2018. And, you know, we've been keeping pretty close to our timeline thus far, and done all the great work that they've been doing to help drive us. Board actions for you that I want you to kind of keep in mind as we're having these conversations and we're going to revisit at the end of the designation conversation. So we'd like you all to, of course, provide feedback on a two-step registration and designation process that we're proposing, that the subcommittee is proposing, not me. Provide feedback on how the rules should, one, enable existing HIEs to continue operating in the district, but then also how it encourages new HIEs to enter the market. Two things to keep in mind. And then at the end of all that, we will conduct a vote to make a formal recommendation to DHCS based on your review of the HIE definition. And with that, Madam Vice Chair, I will turn it over to you.
Okay. So I think we've been, through our meetings, we've been really focused on how to define HIE and what our rulemaking really will do to facilitate the implementation of HIE in the district. I know there's been a definition that's been circulated in the past about what the DCHIE is, so we're focusing on coming to agreement on what that definition is, but also how it gets implemented through a variety of entities. I think we've all sort of come to the conclusion that the DCHIE is an HIE of HIEs. It's a network of HIEs that come together to provide a set of services to participants, and defining how the rules should apply in that circumstance. We're not talking about a central system necessarily, but we're talking about how the rules apply to systems that come together to provide a central service. So one of the things that we looked at, at least in the last meeting, was number one, coming to agreement about what the definition of the DCHIE is, and then what an HIE entity is, because those are the two things that we're really developing rules around, how those things come together. And I think it's to take a look at these definitions and provide feedback on them, so that we can say, okay, this is where we all are in agreement, and we want to move forward with rules that address how these things interact with one another. Feedback.
Do you want to take them one at a time, Donna? Would that be helpful for folks? Sort of starting with how we've looked at what the function is, and then how these concepts, sort of nouns, might interact with one another?
So just looking at the definition of the DCHIE, we say that it's a statewide health information exchange, is an interoperable system of certified and designated HIE entities. So those two things are pretty key, because when we get to the entity definition, that's sort of the level that we need to define what makes up or what comprises a designated entity versus a certified entity. And
or registered.
Or registered. Is it registered?
That's on us, Doug.
That's
we're
that's
sorry.
On us.
We missed one.
Okay.
That's on us. That should read registered, not certified.
Okay.
DCHIE, so the Statewide Health Information Exchange Interoperable System of Registered?
Yes, ma'am.
Registered and
that term defined on the next slide.
Does the HIE only ride on top of other HIEs, or does it have EHRs feeding directly to it?
As it's currently conceived, it has EHRs are not directly connected to a central system. They're connected to components that make up the DCHIE.
Okay, so by saying that it is the overriding layer, there's only exchanges underneath it, and underneath those exchanges are EHRs.
Right. Yes.
That's right.
And there may be services that are offered at the DCHIE level that are sort of that tool. There are tools that are being developed at the HIE level.
Understood. Okay. That kind of complicates it. I just wanted to keep it very simple in the definition.
Okay.
That helps.
And this is Kelly Cronin from ONC. I'm really sorry that I have to drop off. For some reason, this wasn't on my calendar when another meeting got scheduled. But I would potentially like to offer to have another follow-up discussion with folks in ONC who are working on the implementation of 21st Century Cures, and how that might impact your plans, and whether or not you are right now contemplating the role of Commonwealth or Direct Trust or some of the other exchanges that might be outside of CRISP and the other HIE's efforts that you've been collecting information on through the qualitative research. So I think just because there's a lot of things that could be happening over the next year that would, like on a federal and city-state level, it might be good to connect specifically about that.
Yeah, so hi, Kelly. This is Noah Smith. Thank you very much. We would love to continue that conversation. We'll just let you know that we've talked to Lee and Rachel at ONC quite a bit, and we'll be attending the Trusted Framework meeting on Monday.
Perfect. Okay, good. Well, maybe we could talk more then.
Okay.
But yeah, I think I think it's not that it's not inconsistent. I just think there's a lot you'll want to take into account that could be helpful, hopefully. and it's emerging too. I mean, this is, as you know, these rulemaking processes take place over a number of months, and it's hard for us to reveal exactly, you know, what the thinking is in advance of any kind of publication of an NPRM. That said, we should talk more about, you know, how this might interact. And I'm glad you've already talked to Lee, especially about it. And also, I'm going to try to rejoin at 11:30. I don't know why we never didn't get calendar invites or something happened around this, but I will try to join back.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Kelly. Do you want to just expand on that product, or maybe will you do, like, you know, just so folks are aware of what this, you know, there may be changes in the next year, portends?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Kelly, do you have another minute? We'd love to have you do it, but
I'm late for this other call with NIH, so, but I will rejoin, and I'm happy to elaborate later.
Okay, great. Well, maybe do you guys want to just talk about it briefly, and then yeah.
So,
or do you want to come up just so we can make sure folks on the phone here?
Hi, my name is Rachel Abbey, and I'm with ONC, and I've worked with NOAA for several years, particularly around the Emergency Medical Services Connectivity HIE. I've been at ONC several years, so I also was a DC project officer.
Yeah.
So I know some of you well. So anyways, I wanted to share that, so there's a meeting about the trust for, about 21st Century Cures asks ONC to push forward a trust framework at the federal level. And so we are starting a series of three stakeholder meetings, one on Monday, of which NOAA is going to be attending, and I think maybe Erin or someone else from
someone
staff
else, I think,
will also be attending. and so there will be presentations from the various existing trust framework networks that are out there. These are networks of networks that they have come together that on various use cases for sharing data that could be differ across entities. It could be for sharing of federal data, such as the eHealth Exchange with the Social Security Administration and the VA participating in that. So as HIEs become more robust in this space, they're becoming, they're depending upon their use cases of data sharing and their agreements with their organizations that are sharing data, they may decide to join many of these networks to also begin participating with them across various other entities. And some of them are very large, some are very small, some are built on very specific use cases, things like that. But anyways, so the Monday meeting is more or less to get out in the open in regards to who these networks are, what they are doing, and to kind of begin framing out some sort of national direction around trust framework. So that's pretty much it.
That sounds so easy. Yeah. I think our challenge, right, is to ensure that our definitions would be flexible enough to allow DC to sort of grow into that trusted framework structure, even though we may not be there today.
Right. And in fact, I'll just add, we've been having some conversations with Maryland about how their definition of these concepts is evolving, and it really, one of the sort of stickiest wickets is this issue of how you ensure there's interoperability between networks, right, which ONC is obviously working on, as Rachel just talked about. And then the other piece is how do you deal with the sort of HIEs that are a little bit different than we think of them now, right, but the national networks of, say, vendor-based exchanges, right? And I think what Maryland has found is that their current definition of an HIE anticipated some of the nonprofit entities like CRISP, but it didn't necessarily think about for-profit entities that would also have some other incentives, perhaps, for keeping information within their network and not doing the same kinds of exchange or having the same kind of public trust necessarily that some of the nonprofits do. So just trying to think about all those issues so that we ensure we're really future-proofing this.
Yeah, and I think, too, I think it's D.C.'s in a great place because you all can it's going to be really difficult for HIEs that have been established for a while, such as Maryland and some of the other more mature ones that already have gone through this process and already have sort of established governance guidelines, per se, to kind of begin thinking, and they may need to, you know, modify things as they continue to grow and mature, whereas you guys will be able to kind of grow with it, and I think that that's kind of exciting, and I think that's really a plus, I think, in that sense.
Right. So that's terrific. Thanks so much, Rachel. And I'll just add that I think as this dovetails with our earlier conversation, understanding what providers and provider networks look like and connectivity with providers, right, then understanding you know, the existing exchange frameworks within the district and the providers who are here to serve those services, putting those two things together is going to give us a very different kind of mental map of the virtual network of information exchange within the district, which of course is needed for any integrated model of care. So so I think this is just, you know, kind of continuing to keep those threads between these streams of work is important. So that was great. Thank you all very much. So Denise, back to you and Donna with the definition.
So the definition of the DCHIE is one that we've looked at before. We've had some agreement about general scope, but I think what we realized is that doesn't necessarily address the requirements for the organizations that actually operate HIE. And we focused on creating a definition for an HIE entity and then looking at rules around how those HIE entities should, what kinds of requirements those entities have to meet in order to become a registered entity with the district versus a designated entity. We also talked about the two levels of certification, registration, designation, recognition, two levels of recognition. And sort of introduce the concept of a registered entity and the definitions of those are provided. So on slide 25, we talk about what a registered HIE would be. And a registered HIE is an HIE entity that's applied for registration, and there would be an application process that we would create that would set sort of a minimum standard for registration in the district with a focus on privacy and security requirements. It's very similar to a current registration process or certification process, I think it's called, in Maryland. But it offers a couple of benefits, I think, for an HIE entity that wants to be a participant in the DCHIE. Number one, it establishes a sort of a recognition factor so that as you're offering that service to providers in the district, they have some sense that the organization is embedded organization, that you meet certain requirements, and that participation is sort of sanctioned by a government entity, by DHCS. It defines the ground rules for that entity to continue participation or to continue down the path towards a designation if that's what they choose to do at some point in the future. And you know, looking at some of these things like the trusted framework, trusted exchange framework, and all of those kinds of requirements, it helps those organizations prepare to participate more fully. So the intent is to create a registration process that says, yeah, if you want to be recognized in that way, and have the benefit of some government support from the perspective of your longer term development goals as an HIE, then this is sort of the first step that you have to take. Then there's the next step of designation, which takes you to another level. There are the requirements that you have to meet, and I think that part of the requirements are about meeting some of the objectives that the district government has in terms of exchange, participation in public health reporting, making sure that, that folks exchange data consistently with other HIEs, that there's a connectivity expectation that gets supported by the designation process, and that as a designee, you the benefits are a little bit more extensive in terms of district support for continuing operations. The intent is to not limit participation, but to provide a framework for multiple organizations to participate at the levels that they think are most beneficial to them. So that's the scope of it. Yeah.
Wow. Thanks. This is really exciting. And I'm sure there's a lot more detail sort of buried in the documentation that you guys
are like a 54
page. Yeah.
But make a document that's being developed.
One of the benefits that you mentioned earlier, I wasn't quite sure, was reflected on the side, which is the ability to actually use any tools or services that are established at the DC level. That is the expectation that you would only be able to take advantage of those if you were either designated, well, registered and then designated?
Well, I think of the tools that we're developing being available to the participating entities as opposed to the HIE entities, and maybe that's, you know, they're being made available to the participating organizations, like the provider organizations, as opposed to the HIE entities. And I think through the integration of these HIEs, those tools become available to the participants of those HIEs.
Yeah, so I totally agree, Don. I think linking to Allison's point, I think what you're suggesting is that the tools that are built be tested with or certified for use with all of the certified or registered entities, right? So one thing that you know could be done, right, is if there's a designated entity or designated entities that are developing new HIE tools, there could be a requirement that says you must test and sort of plan for development, you know, and deployment within the registered HIEs, right? Because one of the concepts, and I was realizing I can't write on that whiteboard, you need special pens to do it, otherwise we get in trouble. But otherwise, it would be helpful to see this, right? Because the notion is that the DC HIE would be comprised of both the registered and the designated entities, and that would, I think, be consistent with the notion that any tools we build should, at a minimum, meet the needs or be functional for those HIEs.
More oomph for being designated.
So there would be more requirements, and then in addition, only designated entities could receive funding directly from DHCF.
Well, more requirements is not always a benefit.
Well, yeah,
the funding is the main difference. Well, earlier I thought I heard that the tools went to the designated for use, but now I'm hearing they go to all.
Yeah, so the funding is typically to build those tools, right? Mm-hmm. So the funding would, the funding and tools would sort of, you know, flow together, mm-hmm. and then there's potentially the opportunity to kind of keep maintaining or provide those tools as a service.
Okay, so the real difference is funding.
I guess I was imagining that there might be some HIE level services that may not be accessible to all of the participating HIEs, and therefore it would also be a benefit to them to be able to access them if they were designated. But that could change over time, right?
Wait, can you say that again, Erin? Can you say that again? Some HIE level services that are.
So, you know, say that a more sophisticated HIE that's designated, or there's infrastructure that's developed at the DC government level,
you could have as a potential benefit for other designated HIEs, that they too would get access to those tools or services, which, you know, makes it a benefit to them because they don't have to build from scratch, right?
Right. But so I guess part of my
Aaron's pulling out the alternative.
No, but I think that there's still a question around with the designation piece. We haven't gotten really into the details of the criteria, because if you're allowed to be a participating organization without meeting the criteria of designation, if designation has security requirements in it, you may not want participating organizations to be able, you may not want anyone to be a participating organization who is not designated.
Oh, sure.
So I still have some of those kind of challenges.
Where we ended up at the last meeting was sort of really trying to delineate the difference between a designee and a registered entity, and whether there was significant difference that it made sense to have a two-tier.
Right. We have all arrived at this, you know, the statewide HIE is an HIE of HIEs. And then there's these participating organizations that are these HIE entities. And that being a designated HIE comes with being eligible for some of the resources that come through the IAPDs and perhaps local resources that may flow. But at some point, we're going to have to get into the criteria of designation, and there may have to be also criteria for participating organizations that has a floor as well, because you're not going to want even participating organizations to be able to attach to your statewide HIE if they don't have a threshold of certain criteria.
Right.
I mean, you know, just because you can exchange information within your CIN doesn't mean that we should allow you to attach to the statewide HIE if you don't have certain security protections in place, if you create a vulnerability for everybody else's data.
So that's where the registration process came in, because we said that'll be a step down. There are requirements, privacy and security requirements at the registration level, but it may be that the entity is just not at the level yet to become a designee.
Right.
So there's a minimum criteria.
And that's how I was reading the definition of participating organization, is that they would they're entering an agreement with an HIE, you know, entity.
Right.
And so they must satisfy all the terms and conditions, which I assume would include.
Right.
You know,
typically,
right.
though, a participating organization, I think, from this perspective, is a provider organization like Unity, for example, where Unity offers access to their providers, allows their providers to use an HIE to support certain things.
Got it.
And that's sort of a different kind
Unit. It's at a lower level than the actual HIE entity. Which would have to meet also privacy and security standards. So it's trying to find what is this very, 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 very small gray area between a non-designated HIE and a designated HIE that doesn't make everybody want to become a designated HIE.
Well, so in Maryland they've done this by trying to reduce the burden of applying, you know, or going through the registration process, right? And so we were looking at the forms. I mean, it's not a minor undertaking, but it's certainly not the requirements and audit and all that other kind of stuff that you would have with a designated HIE. So, I mean, that's definitely a clear point of distinction we'll have to bring back to the group, or those, you know, levels. And I think when we follow up and send out materials for review, looking, for example, at Maryland's 14-page registration fillable PDF, right,
mm-hmm.
and compared to the pages and pages of requirements for a designation process, being an annual audit and all that kind of stuff, I think makes it relatively clear. But if this is helpful, what I try to do is put these concepts, you know, in a framework, which is, if this is the DCHIE, right, and given the definitions that Donna's describing, A and B designated entities that are building tools, receiving funding,
right, CV and E are registered entities that are cooperating with, working with, you know, identified as part of the BCHIE, you know, there are other HIEs, and then these are all the sort of participating organizations that are, you know, working with these various HIEs, and the notion is that anybody within the space should absolutely be interoperable, connected with one another, or able to receive information.
Another place that the subcommittee was considering, and another, maybe another perspective on this, is that the registered HIEs are sort of a way to get a handle on
who's out there.
Actually, who's out there, right? That's how Maryland used this process, was to say, we need to know who's operating as an HIE in Maryland right now. They didn't know that several years ago, and they know that now. And I think that would be a really valuable information to have for the district going forward, especially as we're encouraging this market and encouraging more folks to come in. The designation piece, to your point, Dr. Nesbitt, is one way to think about it is you know, you may only want to designate groups and fund groups with government dollars that are providing services to a broad range of district providers. So one thing to think about is whether designated HIEs would have to be nonprofits, or whether they would have to meet certain criteria in terms of connectivity to the entire health system, or whether they need sustainability requirements, so that when the IAPD funding runs out, we're ensuring that those that core functionality continues for those designated HIEs that we're really putting our trust in and partnering with. So I think that's an important distinction as well between registered and designated as we're conceiving it right now. I'm thinking of it as really about sort of core functionality for the whole system, for the universe of providers in the city that we would want to rely on for our value-based purchasing initiatives going forward. What do we absolutely need in the district? And then let's designate those functions. Let's designate the HIEs that would maintain those functions for us, and let's make sure they're appropriately resourced. But I don't think that I don't think I have 100%. I don't think everyone's exactly on board with the way I just described that, just because we haven't talked about it in any way. That's sort of where I'm coming in.
It is worth noting, too, that Maryland now recently has SureScripts, or was it AllScripts?
SureScripts.
It was SureScripts,
SureScripts, yeah.
As a registered entity, and they also have the local public health department come in as registered entities, and then I think now they have 9 registered entities in total, but obviously only 1 designated HIE. Now, they define that there would only be 1. So that's another bridge we will have to cross with you all likely in September.
I have a question. So is there some sort of shared services platform that may help also distinguish between registered and designated entities, or is that something that the
Well, so it's a great question. So because we operate through grants, right, the we have to sort of say we're funding you to do the DDI, or funding, you know, the designated entity right now, those who receive the grants, to sort of build that common services platform. So, for example, in the current grant, CRIS is building unified landing page, which will provide a lot of these services right now. So, you know, we have to sort of figure out, like, that's a utility that the grantees build. So we don't actually own that utility.
Right. But are you gonna ask, like, the registered or the designated folks to say, okay, you have to provide these basic types of services for all your aiding organizations?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, that's totally consistent with the structure of the designation requirement. So as Dr. Nesbitt was saying, you know, we get into the details of really what the requirements are, and that's in, I'll use Donna's prop, the 57-page draft. You know, there's a lot more information, but it definitely gets to all those points. That's a great point. Allison, do you have a question? And then I'm going to ask us to sort of move to next steps.
It was just a quick question about whether or not there was a time frame associated with being registered or designated. So is it delimited time, like you have 2 years and then you have to re-up, or? Yeah.
Yes. So I think Maryland, oh, now I don't remember, but I think Maryland is something like registration for 2 years, 2 or 3 years, and designation for 5 years.
Yeah.
Okay. But that's open to, obviously, recommendations from this board.
Thanks.
Is Dr. Freeman?
Great. I think so. I'm sorry, who was that?
Dr. Freeman.
Dr. Freeman. Dr. Freeman?
Yes, sir.
Are there ways in which one would lose one's designation or registration? Has that been part of the consideration? Other than just expiring?
I'm sorry, Dr. Freeman, we're having...
To lose it if you violate it.
There are certainly requirements.
Yes.
Yeah, so again, in the more detailed language, there are certain things that particularly the designated entity has to do on an annual basis to preserve that status, and the same is generally true for the registered entities.
So, Dr. Freeman,
is there going to be any testing that's part of whether or not they are conforming? I mean, it's easy to say you've got the equipment, but private security is also an issue of behaviors of people within that organization. So will there be some entity that is checking to see whether or not people are conforming to HIPAA and other things like that?
Yes. Noah, do you want
to? So this is Noah, Dr. Freeman. That's a fantastic question. So just to follow up on your first question, there is enforcement action written into the rule right now, into the draft rule right now. And interesting questions about whether we have the appropriate resources to do that, and we have to think critically about what the level of effort is going to be for this at DHCF over the next several years. So I think that plays into this conversation. In terms of testing, I don't think we have a great answer on exactly how that will work right now, but I agree it's required. The folks in Maryland have said that they contract with a group to ensure that their designated HIE is meeting standards. We're sort of, this is just a conversation Aaron and I had earlier this week, actually, about the word certification versus the word registration. To me, certification actually means that you went through some kind of test and you were certified as meeting some kind of requirement. I don't think that's our intention with the registration process, and that's not how Maryland has done it before. I'd call it more of an attestation process than I would a certification process. That's certainly up for debate and questioning among the subcommittee and this group. I think for the designation, we would want to have some level of testing or standardization and meeting national standards, right, for designation. I don't know how that works, though, so we'll have to find out how other states do it.
Great. Well, thanks, Matt. So, Donna, back to you on the next steps in board action. Thanks for a great discussion.
Yes, so, the first thing is that I think we need feedback on the two-step process, registration and designation. And I don't know how you want to get that feedback, but...
So, may I make a suggestion to the group? At this stage, it sounds like there's still some feedback that you may want to share and kind of think through the definitions, and we definitely don't want to kind of force a vote or, or to make a quick decision here. Would it be helpful if we were to send these definitions out to you, and we give you maybe a week or so to come back to us to provide your feedback and then perhaps do a vote at the next policy board meeting?
Well, I think you might even be able to get feedback online from folks just to move this forward. Because this is obviously these definitions are really a critical building block for the rest of the draft. So if folks are willing, I think that's a great suggestion, Denise, to send out the materials again. I was actually, we might want to do a figure as well that helps people visualize how these things interact. And then, just have a couple slides that we'd send out for any comments or edits. And then, just ask you all to respond within a week, and then we'll do sort of a final call for comments. And sort of a, speak
Aaron,
now.
Aaron, if I may, I'm going to move approval of the definitions pending technical corrections based on input over the next week by staff.
That's a terrific motion. Is there a second? Group? I think you are, yeah. Is there any opposition to taking that approach? So that would allow us to move forward without another formal vote, but everyone would still have the opportunity over the next week to offer technical corrections, and if there was any major sort of sticking points or areas of disagreement, we could certainly, you know, continue to make that amendment. I'll assess if there are any objections to that motion. Okay, so seeing none, I think we can move forward. Great.
Great. I will send those out this evening.
Yes. Don't we turn to our guests? Thank you very much, Donna and Denise. Let's turn to our guests from Chris, who are going to talk to us about the progress that's being made with the HIE tools currently under development. And so, Andre, are you going to present or is Scott on the phone?
No, Scott's on the phone.
Okay, great. Do you want to just introduce yourself really quickly for everyone?
My name is Andre Jeffson. I'm one of the project managers for the HIE. On the phone, we have Summit. Summit, can you introduce yourself? He's our chief medical officer, but I'll let him do his intro.
Sure. Summit Desai, an ED physician and a senior advisor to CRISP.
Great. And I'm Jim Yunkin, senior director. I just joined the team a week ago. But before that, I was the HIE director in Pennsylvania for the Keystone Health Information Exchange, and I know several of the folks here from ONC as well. So it's great to be here. We're excited because we have the fun part of showing you the tools that are under development. So I think Andre, we're going to start with Summit.
Yeah, but before we show what's being developed, I think Summit wants to kind of frame up the information that we're going to show you. So he's going to run through a user story. Aaron, can you let me present my screen?
We don't have those on there, Andre.
No, I have them. So if you stop sharing your screen and I present, then I'll be able to pull it up.
Which
one?
I do not.
Okay. Right.
So while Andre is doing that, this is Summit. I just wanted to introduce, I'm sure many of you are familiar with this concept of user stories as a basis upon which we may determine requirements and proceed with development. And it also just helps us envision how the product may lead to tangible action and value. Which we know we're all keen on understanding as it supports the MyHealth GPS initiative. Let me know, Andre, when you're sharing.
Give me 20 seconds.
Sure.
So, Simon, do you just want to orient folks to the conversation that we had last week with the MyHealth GPS work group and where these user stories were refined? Maybe just a little bit of background would be helpful for folks.
Sure. There are, we'll be presenting just one here, but there, of course, can be any number of user stories given all the different data sources we have accessible to us and that we want to make available intelligently to the particular users who will be participating in the program. And I think once we walk through this one, we'll probably go through, and Jim will take over then, go through the different sections, widgets, whatever you want to call them, so that folks can see them and can begin to imagine how a physician or a care manager or care coordinator may leverage it when they see a particular beneficiary, either in their office or sort of asynchronously as they're continuing to perform the care coordination.
So
the top line, go ahead. Sorry, maybe I didn't answer it exactly how you'd like.
Just remind everyone, we're doing the initial implementation of these HIE tools in the context of the Health GPS care coordination program because we have a set of 12 providers from 33 clinics who have a strong set of financial incentives and organizational and operational incentives to try and reduce the number of visits
really take that interest and our to heart. And so I think there's, you guys have been getting some good feedback from the rest of the folks in those practices about what their role is going to be. So.
Okay, Summit, the information.
I'm just gonna read through this, and then Jim can demo the product and walk you through it. So this is, I am a care manager at a primary care practice that is a designated MyHealth GPS site. And as part of our onboarding of a new patient, I performed an in-person assessment when she visited our office. And I used the patient care profile to better understand her medical condition, noting that she suffers from type 1 diabetes, hypertension, as well as bipolar disorder. And that speaks to some of the chronic illness that is a precondition for entering the program. Upon further review, I noted a recent admission to an area hospital where she was admitted for 4 days for diabetic ketoacidosis. And while she has filled her quetiapine, a medication for her bipolar disorder, she's not filled her lithium in 4 months. Similarly, she has filled her metformin, but not her Lantus. So the lab data from the hospital shows a subtherapeutic lithium level of 0.1 and an elevated hemoglobin A1C. And during this outpatient visit, we discussed why she hasn't filled her lithium, which she says makes her feel poorly. And I educate her on the importance of the medication to keep her mood stable, and that feeling mentally well allows her to better care for her diabetes. And so then we'd also note numerous ED visits in the preceding months for both hyperglycemia and depression. And we discussed the willingness of our practice to meet her health needs, as well as to coordinate her care to address her mental health needs. And so in that user story, we stitched together information that are coming from, again, many places, some of which are coming from the encounter notification system, where we know who is following or attributed to a patient, coming from claims data that tells us when medications have been filled, and when reconciled against diagnoses, the discerning care manager or doctor will note the absence of certain filled medications, which goes right to the heart of gaps in care, and is a teaching moment or a moment to help assist a patient, either with transportation to get to physicians or programs that help them fill their medications. So not all-encompassing, for sure, just one story that hopefully gives folks in the room a sense of the power of the tool that we're about to demo. And with that, I'd hand it to Jim, unless anyone has questions.
Yeah, any questions? All right. Actually, Andre is going to take the first part of this, so go ahead, Andre.
Yeah, so what you're seeing here is the landing page. Let me go ahead and log in.
Can everyone on the phone, do you all have access to the demo that Andre's doing right now?
Upon logging in, the next screen you'll see is our patient search. The patient search is basically utilizing our MPI technology, our Master Patient Index. So what this essentially does, it uses a combination of some algorithms, some fuzzy logic to basically to ensure that the patient that you're putting in here is truly the patient that you're searching for. So for an example, I'm going to type in John Smith. And depending on the different variations of how that name is spelled out, date of birth, it'll pull up as many results as it determines that it's matched. And then you can make a determination of whether if that's the patient that you're truly searching for. So what you'll see here is the system basically pulling back two John Smiths, first and last name. It's all spelled the same. Date of birth the same. The only difference here is the address. The system will put a score on here, which is very likely. So it looks like both of these could, you know, very well be the John Smith that you're searching for. For the purposes of the demo, we'll go ahead and select the second match here is very likely. Now, from this screen to get to the patient care overview, all you really have to do is do the click on the search. But so what you'll see here is basically the patient care overview, and I will let Jim kind of talk through the various widgets. Keep in mind the user story that Summit just kind of highlighted to us, and then we'll walk through that user story with the widgets that you're seeing right now.
Great.
Can I ask a question about
Yes, ma'am.
Can you search for any patient? Like, how do you know, I mean, in terms of privacy, like, that I'm not just saying I want to know Donna Ramos Johnson's record?
So,
because, like, for example, in the HIE, we have ways of ensuring that you can only search for patients that are your patients.
So, I mean, the access to the application is going to be, you know, role-based.
It's going to be web-based?
Role-based. I mean, for the purpose of for this engagement, it's going to be the MyHealth GPS participants. So I think what you're asking is from one provider to another provider, like how do you limit which information you can see?
So basically, as long as that they were a MyHealth GPS patient, we could search the entire universe of MyHealth GPS patients?
I mean, I think...
Isn't it panel-driven? Are you not taking panels from providers as a way of registration?
Yes.
And then that panel drives the search process?
Yeah, so so this is a tool, and it can be implemented in different ways. So one of the things that we want to talk about in terms of the functionality of the security is how much access do we want to provide based on a particular role. So an administrator will have a certain level of functionality, obviously, but we can limit it to the MyHealth GPS panel as well. And if we need to limit it, and we have to be careful about this, to a particular office's panel, you know, because it could be a new patient, right? A new patient for the practice, but they participate in the MyHealth GPS program. So we want to enable them to be able to look up those patients and be able to pull in their records from those other places for being able to care for them. Is that getting at the concern?
Yeah, it is. I think we would want the latter, though. I mean, that the patients are impaneled to the practice, and then the practice can pull the impaneled patients. I don't think you want to be able to pull the whole universe just because all 25,000 patients. That's my
powerful.
Which to me is a little bit different than the role.
Yeah.
Well, so it's sort of the definition of the role, and we can have a longer conversation, but I think at a minimum we want to make sure that all the health homes, that you could access anyone who's assigned to a particular health home.
Yeah.
Permission, right?
That's what I was looking for.
Yeah, okay.
I
just wanted to clarify.
Make up a patient, and that's not necessarily a Unity patient, and search in there for that patient.
Yeah, so let's have a longer conversation about that in the context of the program, because there were, in the data sharing work group, there were a couple of different discussions that we had about the level of sharing that might be ideal. So,
and the other piece of it is that the widgets may change based on role. So it may be that for some things that don't get to see all of the medications, or you don't get to see all of the diagnoses if you're a certain role.
So what you're saying is, like, if this particular person here is from Providence, then you would only be able to see the patients from Providence and not be able to switch outside of that. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Now, I did just hear about a use case, just something to think about. Last week I did a presentation for the ED at the ED leaders meeting, and there was a lot of discussion about the extent to which they're not ED providers are not necessarily referring people back to a group that they may have previously assigned to. So I think it's an interesting question to think about, whether somebody gets referred to an ED visit to another provider who is not their assigned MyHealth GPS provider, but we want those folks to have access to this information so they know to kind of shoot them back to their primary care I would think
that's part of the problem. People get sent willy-nilly, and then they go to a whole new provider, and then have to do the workup and end up on different medications.
Right.
And, I mean, that's the
whole point. Yeah, so I think this is
trying to promote consistency.
Right. So I think probably a longer conversation, because we really want to make sure you guys get some input on widgets and information. Great question.
Yeah. So the nice thing about the concept of a unified landing page is that it can be a source where you pull information in from a lot of different places. So we're going to show you what's on the roadmap for the initial implementation of this, but keep in mind that we have a lot of flexibility if there are additional data sources that we could have access to. That can be brought into this as well and linked together under a common thread to pull the patient data from multiple sources.
In the next phase of development, right?
Yes, in the next phase.
Yeah, agreed. So, yeah, this is just what's being contemplated now. The other thing about this framework is that it's very flexible so that a user different users may do their work differently. So, for example, if I wanted to see encounters at the top of my list, I can drag that section up and just kind of customize it so that it works better for the information that I need to do my job. So I'd like to get your thoughts or input on which widgets we have in this version, and then the content of them as well. To hear your thoughts on that. Speaking of the encounters, we're currently showing ADT information for the last 6 months. We, with the work group last week, decided we would split these out so that information that came in through our encounter notification service could be displayed in one place and claims information in another, because we have slightly different information that we can display from either of those sources. At some point in time, we may want to put them together and just say, here's all encounters, but for now, we're looking at having those in two separate boxes.
Right, and the notion was they'd be proximal, right, but not in the same widget.
Yep. And we wanted
to. Who's in the work group?
So it's My Health GPS. So there.
Yeah. I wanted to also point out from the use case that Samit walked through, we did include some behavioral health information in here just so you could see how it could be displayed. Initially, there was a widget. Actually, I think it's down here at the bottom, behavioral health indicators. But we haven't yet determined, you know, what information would have to reside in a separate behavioral health section. Our thinking, and help us with this, is that information such as diagnosis of depression or bipolar or something like that could show up in your diagnosis section, which we have over here. Likewise, the medications, you know, it's so critical to have an accurate medication list. You know, you don't really want to have separate medications in a different place or under different privacy rules if you don't have to.
I just had a clarifying question about the you mentioned that widget around the ADT and the decision point there, because those aren't that list that you have there as a, I guess, prototype or example, is not the traditional types of ADTs, because the counseling center or office visit would not be a typical ADT. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I put that in there because we're thinking that we might be able to get office visit information from claims data.
Okay.
So even though this is ADT encounters, I asked them to include it here just so you could see that, you know, counseling information.
So any claim, any encounter could be there, not just ADT.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Any process claim.
Right. And Andre, just to clarify, you guys are still thinking about doing this sort of timeline widget, right?
Yes.
So there'll actually be a visual that will show They'll have sort of color-coded encounters, whether their office visits or, you know, we're hoping that we can include FEMS information so you can actually see whether there were ambulance calls that either resulted in transport and admit or did not. So you can actually see the chronology for the last little bit.
There'll be a rich UI, which obviously you're not seeing here, but yes, there'll be graphical representation of what you're seeing on the list. And I think we're going to probably remove ADT by just putting counters in the past 6 months just so that people just don't get focused on that. Because it will, the information here will be made up of various sources, not just, you know, ADT.
At the same time, while we're talking about this, one of the reasons that people talked about separating the claims from the encounters is because there obviously is some concern right now that we need to work on improving the quality of the ADT data, you know, so that we have real confidence in that information and the way that's being exchanged across partners across the district. So.
Yep. Yeah. So. Just in the interest of time, I want to just give you a highlight on what the different widgets are. Move the encounters to the top. But underneath and on the left-hand side, we have medications. We've separated out diagnosis information. This is another one that may come from a clinical document like a CCD, in which case it would represent a problem list or a list of conditions that have been recorded by a physician versus diagnoses that have appeared on claims. So we're thinking we also want to provide the ability to filter and show only the claims-based diagnoses versus the clinical ones. We have procedures. They would also be listed here, allergies, that will only come from the clinical data, and lab results as well. We have a box here for social determinants of health.
Yeah, the lab data will come through what? Where is that exported or expected?
Yeah, I mean, you can pull lab data from an office document if they have a CCD that has that information. If there are laboratory feeds from hospitals, is that
No, go ahead. Yeah. I was just saying it's going to be spotty.
It depends. I think some of the most of the hospitals are sending lab results to Chris. All of the I know that at least for the health centers include the lab results from labs that they've ordered in the CCD, so there will be so it's a combination of things. Okay.
And part of the reason we're going to need to do a lot of technical assistance around these tools, right? Because some of them look kind of ugly when it starts. It's not until we start feeding this information more regularly and working with folks to improve the input that it's going to get better.
Yeah. The bottom box there is social determinants of health and. You know, there's been a lot of discussion around how that can impact patient care and care coordination. Right now, this one is just showing housing data, but depending on what data sources we can get, you know, we could potentially list other programs and you know, whatever the HIT folks can give us access to can also be listed there.
One quick note here, there's been a bit of a delay with DHS and the access to their API. They're still working on it. So that won't be part of the September launch because we can't get that data feed yet, but we're still working on it with them.
And what's the housing data first now?
It's HMIS.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is kind of a manifest destiny, you know, want to get that, but they've asked us, and sorry, Dina's not here today, but they've asked us. Hold off on that a little bit. Got it.
Okay. So on the other side, we have the program and the various providers that have a relationship with the patient. So, you know, we can tell a lot of times from claims data who their primary care physician is, if they're seeing a specialist, that sort of thing, that information would be listed there as well. Our thought is to combine the program
with the provider relationship, so it would just kind of all be displayed together. I know that you all had some questions about the behavioral health information and how that's being displayed. Did you want to talk more about that?
Yeah, so in the interest of time, I know we're almost at the hour. I think, you know, the main purpose of today's presentation was largely to demonstrate progress and that there's, you know, really a working prototype. These aren't just pretty pictures anymore. But I think, you know, maybe we can hold some of that conversation for a separate discussion. Is there anything you particularly wanted to ask the group today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is that the feedback that we've gotten is that the specific behavioral health information can fit into existing sections of the display here. Is there anything in particular that we would want to put in its own behavioral health section and then lock it down based on, you know, certain kinds of privacy rules? Or do we think that, you know, by and large, we should just make it part of the each section that could contain that information?
Dr. Freeman?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think that there are federal laws on the fact that we have to lock down a certain amount of information that falls into that, especially around substance abuse, substance use treatment. So I think, one, we got to adhere to the federal regulations around that. I think there is a broader discussion that we as a policy board need to discuss on how we want to be able to share certain types of information, especially as it relates to this information ultimately being shared with people who are not medical professionals but are providing vital human services. So I think there's a bigger issue in terms of how we would approach that issue that you've raised.
I think that's the discussion they want to have now as they're building this out. So the question becomes, is it appropriate to just list under diagnoses that a person has bipolar disorder and lithium under medication, or should that be in a separate box listed behavioral health? Or should the behavioral health box include that the person was recently in an inpatient rehab facility for opioid use disorder, and that's in a locked box? I think those are the decision points that need to be made in terms of the patient care profile. Or if a patient is on medication-assisted therapy for opioid use disorder, such as methadone or Suboxone, should that be listed under medications just as their hydrochlorothiazide, or should that be under a locked box for behavioral health? So those are the types of questions that we need to answer.
Maybe that's the question, but I thought the question was actually, do we take all of the information that's potentially sensitive as deemed by federal and state regs and put them in one place?
I'm not saying it any different than that, Erin, because the diagnosis of bipolar disorder is a medical diagnosis, but does it meet the strict criteria of needing to be covered under IT standards, given that we have changed the district's laws around being able to share behavioral health information when there is tangible interest and a need to know to be able to medically manage the patient?
Could I just finish the thought? It wasn't whether you hide it, it's where you hide it. Whether you hide it in a field that includes other information like other diagnoses, or whether you quarantine.
It's not hidden if it's under a list of diagnoses that is visible to anybody who can.
But it could be suppressed.
I think that actually most of the MyHealthGPS participants in this process, and you know, we've had a number of meetings with those folks, have said, to the extent feasible and as approved by, you know, DBH and some of the other folks who have responsibility for this data, that they would prefer to see it, you know, sort of in the appropriate areas of information where a care provider would look for it. And that is what came up in the 2015 amendment to the BC Mental Health Act, right, which is if somebody is receiving mental health, is receiving care from, you know, two providers, both of those providers have access to that information on them, And so because our use case here is where somebody is under the care of providers, either for care coordination services or mental health or other sort of specialty services, that all of those groups, you know, right now, if they're connected to the My Health GPS program, should have access to this tool. So if that's helpful, just to kind of set the stage. And obviously, we would welcome more feedback about, you know, with your thoughts about how to do this. We're working closely with DBH on these issues, and from the DCHA committee on care coordination, a number of other groups. But again, absolutely welcome.
Maybe you should circulate the actual district law so people are familiar with how the district law has been changed and what we're permitted to do. And that they're not believing we have an abundance of restrictions that aren't necessarily there.
I think that would be very helpful.
We also would want to circulate CFR Title 42, which addresses the government's position on sharing use treatment information.
Yeah, and just to close the loop with Dr. Freeman, the at least my current understanding is that we don't have any 42 CFR Part 2 facilities today participating in this program. So at least in the first iteration of this, we shouldn't have to necessarily worry about the.
I don't know about that.
Is that not true?
As substance abuse treatment moves to primary care offices,
haven't
without knowing it.
Have a lot of stuff. We're using claim data.
But I don't know if we have any data sources that are
right.
Contributing.
Right, I think that's
data.
Right, because we're talking about initially, and
right.
Brady and I talking before the meeting, largely drawing this information from claims for right now until we have a chance to really talk to DBH about how to handle this in the next step.
Yeah, but it would be including the claim.
It could, yeah.
One thing I wanted to mention just briefly, I don't know if you've thought about the relationship to the PDMP or if there is a prescription drug monitoring program that's maintaining a database of medications prescribed related to, opioid abuse. It's just something to think about because I know other states, for example, Nebraska has a new law that requires all medications written to go to the PDMP. And they're using the data that they're getting to do automated ADT alerts to clinicians or the usual source of care as soon as someone shows up in the ER or in other facilities, trying to get scripts. So there's a lot of utility, and once you figure out where the data should be residing and how it should be protected or available, you can think about then how to use updates for more timely management.
Yeah, that's a great point, and we've certainly been talking with our in Maryland about the use of PDMP, and in fact, you might have even seen on some of the screens because LP that Chris has been developing also includes the PDMP in Maryland. Occasionally on some of these screens, you see PDMP pop up, so that's just an artifact of the design environment, but thank you, Kelly, for that comment.
Yeah.
I realize we are 5 minutes over, and I made myself a promise that we would end on time, but we had such a great discussion today, and I really want to thank all of you. I think, in bringing this meeting to a close, just want to remind everyone that we will be changing the time of the September meeting to accommodate a few of our colleagues, so please be on the lookout for that time change as well as the doodle poll and call for the August meeting to talk about sustainability. Noah, who will that message come from, just so folks can look out?
Denise.
Okay, so look out for a message from Denise with some scheduling information. And otherwise, I just want to thank our colleagues.
Hi,
for
Aaron.
Chris.
I know we're running over, but I think there's one last issue that I'd like to raise just before we go, because I think the whole board needs to hear it.
Okay.
Although I'm listed as working for J.E. Thomas & Associates, I'm actually the National Medical Director of Clinical Documentation Improvement for Nuance. The reason I raise that is I specialize in troubleshooting systems just like the one we just saw presented here. I would love to volunteer my time as an individual or on behalf of the board to help group troubleshoot some of the issues on that. But I don't want to do anything, and then people say, well, who authorized him to do that and who gave him the right to do that? So what is the process for me to offer to help?
That's a great question, and I think, you know, that's not something that I've heard the board has addressed before, whether there's, you know, a conflict with a board member volunteering time to consult on another grant or project. So, Dr. Freeman, why don't I take that as a to-do that we will loop back with you and sort of consult with our grants office about any issues there. Because obviously the key thing is we'd love to have your help, but at the same time we want to make sure that there's not a perception, as you're raising, of undue influence over the course and requirements for the grant. So it's a terrific question. I appreciate you raising it and also offering your time and assistance. So again, I will follow up with you on that. Noah and I will follow up with you on that.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thanks so much. Okay, so with that, again, I want to thank our CRIS colleagues for coming and presenting and the whole team for their great efforts. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Any seconds?
Okay.
Okay.